And welcome back into Morning Drive here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Robbie Stanley alongside Joe Rexroad from The Athletic, taking you through this Tuesday morning here in Nashville, Tennessee. We're about to dive back into the world of college football, and to help us do that, we bring in Nicole Auerbach from The Athletic, who covers college football. Nicole, thanks so much for taking time to join us today. We appreciate it.
Yes, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So problems continuing to emerge in the world of college football with COVID-19, an outbreak at Rutgers, Michigan State, you know, Northwestern's had some, Indiana State announced yesterday, I think 6 players tested positive, forcing a 14-day suspension of football activities. When you look at what's going on right now in the world of sports with the MLB and potentially the NFL, how difficult is this going to be to pull off in college football?
Very difficult. And, you know, I think this is something everyone had thought all along, but, you know, certainly it's different to think about this for 3 or 4 months and, you know, to be anticipating that society as a whole and kind of the communities around these programs would be in a better place, that you wouldn't be putting stress on the healthcare system. You wouldn't be, you know, essentially, you know, taking tests or prioritizing tests while other people are struggling to get them, or it takes 2 weeks to get results back, for regular people in these communities. So, you know, that element has certainly added a challenge. But then to see, you know, how quickly, you know, the whatever plans are in place unraveled with Major League Baseball, I think was a really big wake-up call for all of these people, because it was 4 days into the season, and that was the first sport in the U.S. that was going to be traveling, that was going to be outside of a bubble. So then you're looking at, okay, well, with football, college football and the NFL, you'd be doing both of those things, no bubble and travel, and the sport is players who are right up against each other, and there's no way to socially distance tackling and blocking. And so then your mind starts to wander. And so, I think one thing that we've learned, again, you knew it was a contagious virus, but I think one thing we're learning with, like, the Rutgers outbreak, with the way that it spread through baseball, is just really how quickly this virus spreads and how many people it can impact.
Okay, so at The Athletic, we have the Slack channels, okay?
Okay.
Different sports, so different groups of people, and, you know, you can have individual conversations and things. So our college football Slack channel is absolutely, I can't keep up with it. Like, if I, a couple hours, I'll go in, I'll come back, and it's like 48 new messages, okay? So let's see. Let's just go through the Athletic Slack channel on different things we're discussing.
Is this allowed? Are we allowed behind the curtain?
Well, I mean, we're discussing things that are all public. Like, okay, let's talk about the Big Ten. Stu Mandel, Northwestern pauses workouts. The mom of an Indiana player describes serious COVID complications that he has had. Michigan State has its students staying home. Rutgers outbreak doubles to 28. We have Gary Patterson saying a racial slur. We have Nick Rolovich being taped by a player talking about the Pac-12, We Are United group, and, you know, basically making it sound like he would be off the team. I can't keep up with all this, Nicole. So really my only question for you is, like, are you okay? Because, it's just this sport is absolutely unbelievable right now.
It has been very messy. It's been, you know, it's funny when, you know, during any of this time frame, you think, okay, I can take an afternoon off or, you know, disconnect for a couple of hours. And you really can't do that right now because, you know, you've got basically since last Wednesday, you've had nonstop scheduling news, scheduling models and some actual schedules with dates on them from different Power Five leagues. Then there's the impact of what that means for the Group of Five leagues you got to check in on. Then all of those issues you described. I mean, the Pac-12 player protests, you know, that takes up an entire weekend. You're trying to figure out, you know, how widespread is this? How likely is it that there's actually going to be a boycott? And then all of the other factors. So it's been a crazy time in college sports, and it's all kind of happening at once. And, you know, even some of the things that don't seem connected absolutely are, because, you know, when you talk about players, you know, threatening to withhold their services, you know, part of their platform here and something that has obviously been very important to a lot of players in the last couple months is racial injustice and structural racism and fighting back about different things like that. So, you know, then what happens with, you know, Nick Rolovich at Wazoo and Gary Patterson at TCU, you know, it's connected. It's all connected. And these players have platforms to get their side of the story out, you know, in a way that they never had before. They're comfortable doing it. And then you also have, you know, them realizing that, you know, just how much money is at stake with a college football season this fall, and that if they have demands, if they have things they want to say, they're going to be listened to because, you know, they know how valuable they are. They know what their leverage is. So it is an absolutely crazy time in college sports. You know, later today, there's the NCAA Board of Governors meeting. You know, people I talk to are not expecting a decision on Division I fall championships that are not FBS football, but you really never know. That could expedite some decisions because it would put some pressure on literally everyone in college sports if football is the only sport that is allowed to play a championship and really the only one that's going to kind of happen. So there's just a lot going. It feels like, you know, you talk to different people on the phone and they say, okay, this is, you know, what I think and how I feel right now, but this could change in a half hour.
Yeah, it's wild. And, you know, that Board of Governors, that's an underrated development too, by the way. Mm-hmm. But that's the thing. There's so much going on right now. It's hard to keep up with it. I did want to follow up on the Pac-12 situation, Nicole. Now, I think a lot of what was put out by those players made a ton of sense, and a lot of that stuff absolutely should happen. Some of the financial stuff really can't, as they mm-hmm. described it. But what do you think is the – where do you think this leads?
You know, it's a little early to tell. It's hard to tell. You know, I know that a couple of the, you know, the students who have been the athletes who put their name on things, I know they've already met with athletic directors on individual campuses, at least a couple of them. I think, you know, the Pac-12 has expressed willingness to meet with them. I think that there's a lot of, maybe not a lot, but there's some very reasonable and easy demands to meet. I mean, the first one listed is guaranteeing scholarships if guys opt out. That already exists. That's something the Pac-12 already has made clear, but maybe didn't communicate clearly enough, you know, weeks ago. And so things like that and you know, medical insurance 6 years after your eligibility expires, like, I don't know how that already doesn't exist, right? So there are some small things in there, not small, but, like, significant but relatively easy to implement that I could absolutely see them doing. But, yeah, absolutely, you know, splitting revenue 50-50, you know, that's not something that, you know, the Pac-12 is just going to offer and going to be an easy, okay, we're going to meet your demand on this, especially if you don't even know how many players are, you know, not going to play. You don't even know if there's going to be a season. So I do expect, you know, sides to sit together and meet up. I mean, I think there's a lot of very valid health and safety concerns that have been brought up in that list of demands. And things like, you know, establishing task forces about, you know, race relations and things like that also seem very, very doable.
Nicole Auerbach from The Athletic on the line with us. And, Nicole, I want your opinion on this because Joe and I were talking about this a little bit yesterday. How big of a story would name, image, and likeness be right now if it wasn't for everything going on in college football with coronavirus?
Well, it'd be the number one thing because it's very close to happening. You know, you would be kind of envisioning that new world of, you know, what this is going to look like because, you know, again, so the NCAA is on a timeline where they have to race the clock because Florida has a bill that's going to – a law that's going to take effect next summer. So the NCAA is on these timelines of getting their legislation through, pushing Congress, trying to get that antitrust exemption, all of these things on a very shortened time frame because – whatever is going to happen is going to happen next summer. And we would be talking about that. We would be, you know, I mean, I've written about it and sort of what it's going to look like, you know, what are social media, you know, sponsored posts going to look like and things like that. But it has been very much overshadowed. And then, you know, it's an interesting time for that stuff to be at the backdrop when you have stuff like the Pac-12 player protest, because again, you know, one of the pillars of their protest here is, you know, economic justice and this idea of, you know, the generational wealth that a lot of black and brown athletes are missing because they're most marketable when they're in college and they can't get paid and how that impacts them and their families for the rest of their lives, right? And so all of that is intertwined. And when you open up a name, image, and likeness market, and you're able to, you know, cash in for your likeness, like that is going to have a huge impact. It is tied to, you know, a lot of the issues that we're talking about in society. But it's this different avenue. And so it's really a, really a remarkable time in college sports to have that as the backdrop, be, you know, a year away from that taking, you know, significant changes in name, image, and likeness taking effect, where players can get paid for their likeness, for sponsorship, plus they're realizing the leverage that they have because it's a once in, you know, a century pandemic, and they're being asked to play, and they know how much money is at stake for their athletic departments and schools. And you had George Floyd's killing, and, you know, they're realizing, again, we have leverage and power, and our voices can be heard with that. And it's all of these things happening at one time. So in a different world where it's just one, we would be absolutely focused on it. But all these things are coming together, and it's really creating a very interesting dynamic with player perspective and power and voices and empowerment that, you know, and we know things are going to change, at least in the name, image, and likeness space. So it's this backdrop that I don't think we should forget when we talk about this.
Yeah, and like you said, I mean, these things are all intertwined. I mean, I look at the Pac-12 thing, and I said this yesterday. I said, you know, this to me should lead to fewer ridiculous arguments from people who either are just afraid of this change or like politicians who have no clue about any of this about why name, image, likeness should be capped. I mean, I can see this maybe leading to an actual open free market, which is exactly what it should be. But
I think that's a good point. I mean, there's definitely been, you know, those who support that. The Florida legislation is a free market, right? There's very limited restrictions. But you're right. I mean, a lot of this is like the public perception changed about like, should players in college be able to make money, right? Like that has shifted so much in 5 to 10 years that, you know, even the way you talk about it and what people actually want and what is doable. I mean, the fact that like Congress has bipartisan support for something like this during this time with a really polarized government is remarkable. And so you have a lot of people in Congress pushing for exactly what you just described. And that may only be, you know, that group might only grow because you have a number of congressmen who are very frustrated with the NCAA not implementing national standards on testing. Why are they even trying to force this season through? They're unpaid athletes, right? There's a lot of the same conversations that, you know, we have with people in our space happening at the congressional level, and you're asking them to bail you out, give you an antitrust exemption, be super NCAA friendly with your rules, right? So all of that stuff is intertwined, and it could absolutely impact the way that name, image, and likeness looks and what that market looks like.
Nicole Auerbach from The Athletic has been our guest here on Morning Drive. Nicole, thanks so much for taking time to join us today. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Anytime. Stay safe, guys.
Take a breath, Nicole. It's another long day ahead on the college football beat.
Get out of the Slack channel on The Athletic. Apparently, it's a busy place.
It's amazing. Like most of the sports, it's like a couple messages a day. This, yeah. It's like 200 an hour. It's unbelievable.
When we come back, we'll continue the college football discussion. Get into a big decision made yesterday by the Big 12. That's next. This is Morning Drive on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Welcome back into Morning Drive here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Robbie Stanley alongside Joe Rexrode from The Athletic. Marquise Munson taking you through this Tuesday morning. In Twitter, a fun place, Joe. It's awesome, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay, Tommy Green replies to Nicole's segment, and she was great. Not good takes. Now, see, I see these accounts with a name and then a bunch of numbers after them.
Like they're in like a phone book or something? Yeah.
And usually like they have like 2 followers and then they troll like everything that happens. Does that mean that they're bots? Is this a real person, Tommy? Tommy, are you a real person?
I don't think Tommy's a real person.
Takes bad.
I think this person just started a Twitter just to have that.
Could it be a burner account?
It could be a
burner
account.
Is it a Tommy Green burner account?
Well, so who would it be a burner for?
I don't know.
I don't know.
Someone ripping on Nicole.
A hating college football writer from somewhere. I don't know.
Maybe a rival outlet. Maybe.
Could be.
You never know. I've had some interesting conversations with people
around
here. Yeah, could be about burner accounts. It's
they're prevalent.
There are some possibilities. We got some possibilities. People in this market who have burner accounts out there. But that's all I'm going to say. I'm not ready to go public with it yet.
There's some possibilities for some Some professional athlete burner accounts, too.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Can you say any more?
No.
Okay, you got some ideas, though.
I got some ideas.
You have to tell me during the break.
Yeah, I can do that. Burner accounts, very popular in 2020.
And I don't think what she was saying was takes. I thought those were just reportings. they're not takes. It's not. Right.
Yeah,
like,
what was the controversial take there? There's a lot of, she had a lot of good information. Yeah. To be serious on her takes, I think it's a great point that it is all, there is a common thread with all this stuff with college football right now. And so you're seeing it in all these different stories and different storylines, but it kind of all pointing to, okay, this group, it is a labor group, is really starting to make some noise and get some footing and have a chance to make things better. And there are some things about college football, and I love college football. You love college football. I love college sports. They're a ton of fun. There are some things that just are long overdue for changing.
Yes.
Name, image, likeness, like you pointed out. That would be the dominant story. But I do think that this ends up making that better. I hope so. Because that's the only way that you're going to have this economic. In this model, you are not going to have paid labor. You're not going to have salaries or sharing of revenue.
It's impossible.
Again, college athletics it's a nonprofit organization because it offers these opportunities to non-revenue sports in part. So Title IX is a factor here. The only way to do this is to let the athletes be in the open market, which they absolutely should be with no caps. And hopefully the NCAA shuts up about the capping and understands that the open market fixes a lot of things.
Big news yesterday out of the Big 12. They've announced they're going to a 9-game conference schedule with one additional game out of conference. So I'm trying to keep up here, Joe. So that means the Big 12's at 9 conference games with one out of conference. SEC is just straight 10 games in conference.
Right.
Is ACC 10 plus 1? Are they 10 conference games and then one out of conference? I think that's what they're doing.
So can they go Big 12, ACC Big 12 challenge?
It could be. But you got to be in the same state in the ACC. So it's like.
So they would have to come to them. So it's a big. See, and I have not read a lot on the Big 12, but does that just mean the Big 12 is going to maintain one bye game, essentially playoff game? And as a warm-up and then go from there?
I guess. It's going to be interesting if by some miracle we're able to get this college football season in the fall started and finished normally, like on time, how are we going to determine the playoff and stuff? You've got conferences playing different amounts of games, conferences playing different styles of games in terms of some that are all non-conference, some have out-of-conference games a part of their schedule. That part will be really interesting to try to sort through at the end of the season if everything goes off smoothly, which I think you and I probably don't anticipate that. But if it does, it's going to be really interesting to try to figure out what the college football playoff may look like at that point.
Yeah. If it goes through and they finish, and again, I still can't imagine they'll finish with the exact number of games scheduled, but so that even makes it more challenging,
right?
What you're talking about. But look, hey, they do have a committee, so we don't have hard and fast rules on, you do this and you're in. I've heard some people say, just take conference chance. But, to me, I think the committee is really important in a year like this to try to decipher and judge these teams. Usually you just have a few really big intersectional games that help set the standards for, this league did this against this league or this team against this team. And now this team went over and won its league. So what does that mean about this team? If it's mostly you just played your conference team, some of this is just going to be based on preseason beliefs. But I think that's part of it anyway. I really do. People, if you beat Alabama this year and you didn't beat anybody big out of conference,
you still beat Alabama.
And the committee's going to say that was good. Yeah, that was good what you did. The SEC has a lot of good-looking teams. If you come out of that league with a loss or no losses,
you're getting to the playoffs.
You didn't have to go beat a Big 12 team or an ACC team. Yeah. So, this is a year. If it happens, those committee members Probably have a tougher job, but that system to me still sort of feeds, you know, what they need to determine that. And I would also be okay with a larger playoff this year because it's such a weird year. And that's coming eventually, although I like four. I'd love it to stay at four forever.
I love four.
But, you know, I think that we are going to eventually see that expand.
Oklahoma and Texas did announce yesterday, or it was reported, that they want to keep the Cotton Bowl as their location for the game. They're not interested in getting into a home-and-home type series with Oklahoma and Texas. So,
the fanless, yeah, the fanless Red River rivalry.
Yes, the fanless Red River rivalry at the neutral site. Have they been playing at Jerry World the last couple years for the Cotton Bowl, or are they at the actual Cotton Bowl?
I don't think they played that game they didn't play that game at Jerry World. I'm quite certain of that. Yeah, I thought it was.
Well, it's a good thing no fans will be there then, because social distancing at the Cotton Bowl, if you were there for the Winter Classic, impossible. The most crowded hallways I've ever been in my entire life.
Yeah, those old stadiums, you know.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so, yeah, that is where they've been playing. So, yeah, old school, Cotton Bowl, chicken
That's
soup
what
game.
Happened. So that game is still the same, but now, like, the actual Cotton Bowl in the postseason, I think, takes place at Jerry World.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah, yeah. I covered a Michigan State-Baylor Cotton Bowl at Jerry World. So you're right, the bowl itself is Jerry World.
Okay. That's where I got confused. We're back at it now.
There we go. So, college football, what's your confidence meter right now?
It's getting lower by the day. I mean, we haven't even talked about Rutgers yet. They're having an outbreak. I think originally 15 people were infected. Now it's up to 28. And basically they've determined, or it's been reported,
one party.
That it's a result of a party in a dorm.
Yeah, one party.
So that's what we're talking about with college kids. Like, you think you're invincible, you go do these things that normal college kids do, and then all of a sudden you got an entire team that has coronavirus. Like, it's just my confidence in college football, it's just not there.
Well,
I think it's going to happen.
My alma mater, Michigan State, just asked students to not come.
Yeah.
Which, fine, but again, you guys don't come, you guys play football.
Right.
I mean, it's hard to – and I'm not saying it won't happen. I still think – they're going to make every effort, but the more these things pop up, and a lot of places now we will see the students coming in. How are you keeping 100 people away from a dorm kegger?
It's gonna be hard. Yeah,
I mean, you can't. You know, these facilities are amazing that they've built with all this money in college athletics that has to be spent so they can keep showing nonprofit status, but. They aren't hotels.
No.
You can't.
Not living there.
Although, I guess the LSU locker room, right?
Yeah, you could live there.
The LSU locker room.
Yeah,
like,
pretty nice.
People actually were, like sleeping in there.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they've got athletic – a lot of places have
– under Coach O's watchful
dorm.
Eye.
Yeah. Coach
we're
O.
We're going to play football. We'll play in a pasture field. I don't care.
Bedtime story with Coach O.
That's right.
That'd be – put you right to sleep.
Oh, sign me up, man.
But, yeah, I mean, you got to let them go home and – it's going to be tough enough for the NFL, let alone college football.
When we come back, we'll dive back into Preds and Coyotes game two. Chris Mason, Preds TV analyst and former Preds goaltender, will join us. That's next. This is Morning Drive on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Welcome back into Morning Drive here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Robbie Stanley alongside Joe Rexrode from The Athletic. Preds and Coyotes game two taking place later today. Puck drop at 1:30. And to help us talk a little bit more about that, we bring in our good friend Chris Mason, Preds TV analyst and former Preds goaltender, brought to you by Smoky Mountain Tops, the exclusive partner of the Nashville Predators. Visit SmokyMountainTops.com. See, Mace, what's going on, my friend?
Not much. Just excited and jacked up and ready for game two this afternoon.
So, Chris, what were kind of some of your takeaways from game one and the loss on Sunday, and what needs to change for the Preds as they transition into game two?
Well, some of my takeaways, I think, honestly, a lot of the stuff that happened, I think, could be some of the things that was expected. You know, the talk out of training camp, great training camp. Everybody looked good. Play that Dallas game, first Dallas game, that preseason tune-up game. Couldn't have went any better, to be honest with you. There was no adversity, nothing that this team's really had to go through in terms of, you know, getting scored on. They didn't get scored on the Dallas game, recovering from a goal. You know, getting into penalty trouble. It's just so hard. There's so many unknown quantities when you just play one game. You don't see every situation. They never had to really deal with any big momentum swings. And then so when they, you know, and then they get scored on in the fashion that they did, that first goal, you could kind of see all of a sudden they felt so good about their start. The first 5 minutes, they were all over Arizona, and all of a sudden, boom, you get a goal like that. And they kind of like their eyes went wide, and they kind of just, you know, got hit by a truck there for a minute. And you know, Arizona, in turn, they built off that. They were getting run out of the building to that point. It was only 5 minutes. But then they, you know, the next 7-8 minutes, they were all over the Preds, and that really cost them the game, their ability or their lack of ability to respond to that situation. But again, you know, it's part of the ups and downs, and they went through it now. And I think they really made a big push there in the third. I think Arizona started sitting back a little bit, and the Preds settled in and started to use their speed and, you know, play to their identity, which is speed, and everybody, you know, kind of getting pucks in deep and opening up, backing them off more in the neutral zone, I think, and which allows them to use their speed and then get to the net more effectively. And then they started to pressure Kemper with traffic to the net. So I really thought they settled in. I thought Saros settled in as well. I didn't think he played. I didn't think he was to fault for any of the goals. You know, you'd like to see maybe one more big save in that, you know, that crunch time when the Preds had their backs against the wall. But, you know, you always want that. But I thought he looked really good, and especially in the second half of the game.
Yeah, that killer stretch, Chris, we've obviously talked a lot about that. And, you know, when that happens, you get the crazy bounce, you know, bad break, kind of a stunning moment. And then you have the string of penalties and just, you know, whatever, 10, 12 minutes of the game just flipping on you. In that moment as a team, you know, what can be done to stem that tide? I mean, is that a someone on the bench say something thing? Is that just you got to count on, especially your experienced guys who have been through so many of these high-pressure playoff games, to stabilize things? Like, what has to happen if they come into that type of situation again in this series?
Well, it is a combination exactly of the things that you just said. It's a collective mindset. And I think, you know, when we watch sports, we can all feel those momentum shifts, and we can all feel a team that gets scored on and it doesn't faze them. When they lose a game and they come back the next game and they're not fazed by the situation. And I think in a situation like that, you have players who have been through, you know, they've got a ton of experience. They've been through these battles. They've been through the emotional ups and downs and had to find a way to stay even keel. So you do need somebody on the bench to say, guys, this is nothing. We knew this is going to, we're going to get scored on, you know, and really get that collective mindset. And then once one guy says it, you know, three more guys pass the message on down the line, then all of a sudden it's like, you know, it's water off a duck's back. It's no big deal. You know, this was going to happen. We knew this was going to happen. We've been here before. Now, what's more important? Now, once you get rid of that and you shift your focus, well, your next shift is the most important shift of the game. And then you focus on what you have to do now instead of what just happened, you know, 10 or 15 seconds ago that you can't believe happened, how that goal went in. And you let that affect you. And you give the opportunity, you know, you give the other team an opportunity to get back in the game and make, you know, an impact. And Arizona did. They smelt blood, and they went after it, and they really made him pay in that 8-minute stretch.
Preds TV analyst Chris Mason on the line with us. And, Chris, you know, we do our best on this show not to overreact to one game, which I'm sure you do as well. But I see some things in the Arizona game one that I think are systematic and problematic of what's been plaguing this team for a while. We talked about the second and third goal scored by Arizona. How, you know, Dvorak's just sitting by himself in front of the net taking free wax. Nobody's taking a body. Nobody's moving him out of the way. Clayton Keller all by himself in the slot on the power play. Conversely, on the other side, not getting to the net often enough. We saw it all year long. We saw it last year in the Dallas series as well. Do you think the way this team is structured, do they have the guys necessary to play the way you need to play to win in the playoffs? Can they do these things and get to the middle of the ice? Can they clear out these players in front of the net? And what's it going to take to get this group to do that on a consistent basis?
Well, I 100% think they have the players to do it. I've seen them do it. I think we've all seen them do it. I think at the end of the season, they showed that they're more than capable of playing that lockdown system, taking care of the front of the net, And you look at those goals and, you know, yeah, they were there and you know, Dvorak had his stick loose, but it really happened so fast. And Ellis was there and you have a split second. That puck, you know, they were there and that puck came out from behind the net and then it was a shot and then it was a rebound and it was the bang, bang, bang play. And, you know, they were like, they were in position and you just have to make sure that in that split second that you are, you know, focusing on taking that stick and getting under and lifting so you can't have that rebound. I do think this team is capable. I think a lot of these, it just shows you how little time you have to make that decision when you watch that replay of how much or how little time they have. And even the Clayton Keller goal, that goal was another goal where he just got in that little soft spot. It was a bang, bang play. They executed on those plays. But a lot of that, I think, is just a little bit of rust of not having played. They play one game. They did play that way. They were able to lock it down. They bought in fully to playing a defensive system and taking care of the front of the net, and they executed it perfectly going down the stretch. Now, it's not perfect right now. It's not clean, but I still think that they have a team. And you talked about the Heisman and, you know, all those types of things, and, oh, we lost the game. And this is it's hard for a fan. It's hard for an analyst. It's hard for a player to separate, you know, those emotions. But you have to understand, hey, if they take care of business and they play the way that they did in the third period where they were attacking, they didn't give up much when they did, you know, early in the period, Saros made a couple big saves to allow them a chance to come back, but they dominated the Coyotes and they can, if they play the way that they're supposed to play. And it starts with the defensive side of the game. It puts the puck in your hands a lot more often. And then they used their speed a lot better and got on the transition. But the bottom line is, if they win this game, it's down to a best of three. So you don't look, oh, no, you got to win 3 out of 4 and all this kind of, you know, whatever, you know, all the things that you think about and all the scenarios. If they win this game, it's even. And that's kind of the mindset you have to have as a player. And hopefully you can have that as a fan. And I'll have that as an analyst. I'll probably be saying that here in a few hours. So that's the way I look at it.
Chris, is there any reason to think UC Saros won't be in net today?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that he played well enough. I thought he looked good. Like I said, I can't. There's no goal that he let in that I would fault him for. You obviously want to see that miraculous extra save. I think he made those in the third period when they were, you know, mounting their comeback, especially at a couple 2-on-1s early in the period, one Taylor Hall, and I can't remember who the other one was, but he had a couple really big saves at that junction in the game. It looked like he settled in. He looked the same to me as he did at the end of the season. So, you know, unless you want to, you know, it's a touchy subject decision to make because you don't want to mess with the guys early, especially when he didn't play bad and show panic as a coach. But at the same time, you know, you had another guy, you know, one of the best goalies in the world on your bench right now that's had a great camp and show that he can play in those situations too. But I don't expect the change. Having said that, I'm not the coach, and you never know.
Of course, on this show, we're already moving on to game three. Like, we're speculating on game three and what's going to happen. But
we do.
Yeah. We were talking earlier about, you know, all the different, you know, a win here, a loss here. You play really well. Do you go back with Saros back-to-back? But one thing that we were speculating on, and I'd like to ask you, when it comes to being a goalie and, you know, the strain on a goalie in different situations, like how much of a difference is it if you, say, face, like, 40 shots versus 20 shots? Like, how much more is taken out of you in a heavy work game? And then, of course, as that relates to then trying to come back and play the next day?
You know, I don't know. I mean, for me, I just didn't care. You always want to play. If you ask Pecker, if you ask Juice, they want to play the next day. I mean, if you have practice, if you play a game and then your team practices the next day, yeah, you get 40 shots and it's drawn over and you have all that mental preparation and everything, but you're taking hundreds, almost 1,000 shots in practice. So you're going to go there. And these guys, I tell you, like Juice and Pex, they don't go to practice and go through the motions. They go to practice and they work their butts off. So I mean, players have to do it. These guys are out there killing each other. They're hitting, blocking shots. They call goalies crazy. We got, you know, almost 3 times the equipment they do, and they're putting their bodies on the line. And, you know, we've been fooling them for years. So these players, you guys are crazy. You guys are the crazy ones. But, you know, I personally don't think I think when you play games, you want to keep playing, and especially if you're playing well, and if it's the next day, so be it. It doesn't, in the long term, and when you're planning over a season, obviously you have to, you know, make sure that you're, even though you want to keep riding a guy, I think now we've seen that it pays dividends later in the season, the playoffs. But right now, I got no issue. They got no travel. They're managing their rest. They're in full control of the, you know, everything that's going on around them in terms of the rest and the recovery that they get. So I don't think it's even an issue to be honest with you.
Preds TV analyst Chris Mason has been our guest here on Morning Drive. Chris, enjoy game two, my friend, and thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. Really appreciate it, and we'll be talking to you soon.
Absolutely. Bye. Chris Mason, brought to you by Smoky Mountain Tops, the exclusive partner of the Nashville Predators. Visit SmokyMountainTops.com. We'll be right back, wrap up the show, and give our final thoughts leading into Game 2. That's next. This is Morning Drive on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Stream 102.5 The Game from anywhere. Download the Game Nashville app, enable our Alexa skill or Google Home, and ask to play 102.5 The Game or live stream from our website, thegamenashville.com. Welcome back into Morning Drive. Robbie Stanley alongside Joe Rexroad. And Joe, game two today, 1:30 puck drop, 12:30 pregame here on 102.5 The Game. Going to be a must-win situation, in my opinion, for the Predators. Yes, you can lose this game, and theoretically you can come back and win three games in a row and win this series, but that to me is highly unlikely. A really important game today for the Predators. I think there's a ton of pressure for this core group to prove, number one, they belong together, but number two, that they have individually what it takes to get the job done. Because, Joe, if they lose this series, there are going to be a lot of questions this offseason about the makeup of this group.
No doubt about it. I thought Chris Mason made a good point. I mean, this is how you have to think of it if you're actually playing in this game, is win one, and then it's just even, and
square
it's
it
a best out of three, and look, winning three out of four, I don't know if that sounds daunting or not against Arizona, but this Predators team could beat the Coyotes three straight.
Sure.
If it plays the way it's capable of playing. So you ditch the bad stretch, and I guess you hope you learn from it and don't have any more of those, because I don't care who the opponent is. You have to handle things better than that. And then you have to know that you're better than this team. 5-on-5 and the way your power play's executing, even if it gets a good penalty kill, every reason to believe the Predators should be able to bounce back here.
I thought the top line in game one is okay. I mean, Forsberg scored twice, both of them on the power play, so that's not really the 5-on-5 part of what we're talking about here. I thought Johansson, Arvidsson, Forsberg, 5-on-5, they're okay. Not great, but okay. There's another level for them to get to for sure. Today, though, I'm really looking at that second line. Turris, Duchesne, Granlund. I didn't think they were much of a factor at all in game one, and that can't happen. Like, that can't happen in these playoffs if they're going to make any run. This is literally the reason you went out to get Matt Duchesne, was to have a two-pronged attack in your top six where you have two lines that feel really dangerous. There wasn't a whole lot dangerous about that second line in game one. They've got to be better in game two.
Yeah. No question. And, you know, the line with, you know, the third line that has sort of been really the most reliable line all year, I think you can get more from them too. And you want to defend as little as possible, but when you're in the defensive zone, the little mistakes that can happen in the, you know, in the blink of an eye have got to be cleaned up. And they can't be made, especially by some of your best, highest paid and most veteran players like Ryan Ellis.
Yeah, I mean, that's got to be a problem. And I hear exactly what Chris Mason's saying when he says these things happen really quickly. And they do. Hockey's a fast game, but these guys play at a fast speed too. You got to be able to process and make decisions. You just can't leave Dvorak in front of the net taking whacks. You know, three different whacks at the puck. You can't leave Clayton Keller, you know, finding a soft spot like that in the slot. I understand you're shorthanded. You got to find a way to get in that lane and take that shot away. So it's a little adjustments like that that, to me, the physical part of it is important in terms of actually executing it. But to me, a lot of that is just the mentality of committing to doing it. Like, hey, this guy is coming near my goalie. I am going to move him out of the way. That's got to be your thinking in the playoffs, like when things like that happen, because Arizona knows. Look, they're not the most talented team, other than Hall and Kessel, who have been in this league a long time and have been really productive players. You know, the other guys they have, Dvorak's not going to beat you one-on-one. Like, he's got to do, you know, the dirty things, the nasty things, the gritty things to get to areas on the ice where he's going to score goals. If you're the Predators, you got to take that away. Make Hall and Kessel beat you with some of their skilled plays. You got to take the easy stuff away. That's got to be the mindset heading into this game.
Yeah, and you mentioned a couple of the big mistakes, and of course, Dvorak was there partially because Taylor Hall was, you know, Arvidsson peels away from him, Ellis turns his back to him, and then he ends up with the puck behind the net, and you know, that creates the chaos. I mean, you certainly can't leave 91, ever. I mean, that should be an easy one to put on the board and understand as a team. But it is. It's a fast game. Things happen. Sometimes you get those wacky bounces. And there is, you know, I think UC Saros, again, that would be one of the two things that I really liked out of game one, was how he responded to that situation. That said, there's a little bit of pressure coming off when it's 3-0, and, you know, the game, now you're chasing the game. Now there's a lot of pressure on him in this game. You know, when he gets challenged early in this game, how does he respond to that? There is a lot on Saros today. And again, I'm making assumptions right now.
Me too.
We're making assumptions. I suppose the announcement will be about an hour before game time, right? They come out on the ice. But I would be shocked if it's not Saros. And this will be another really important test of him, because I think his team should outplay the opponent, but there's going to be some moments where he's going to have to step up. And he did so when they were behind in game one, but now I think it's very important. It's always important in hockey, but I think it's important that this team gets that lead, plays with the lead some in this series.
Like, it's easy to say that every game, that it's important, but there are games where I think that means more. I think this is one of them. I think from, you know, a standpoint of confirmation of doing the right things, like if you come out and play the same way you did in the first 5 minutes of game one, if you're the Predators, like, you feel good about that. You just got to score. Like, you got to make them pay in those first 5 minutes. And I think that could be really important. Now, having said that, if it doesn't happen that way, you got to respond better as a group. I mean, this folding the tent for 8 minutes, 10 minutes at a time, and I don't know if it's feeling sorry for yourselves or not just being able to pick yourself back up off the mat, whatever it is, that's got to stop. And that's got to stop today, because that's how you get yourself beat in the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean,
just,
I think
it just can't work.
Yeah, I think it was frustration more than anything, and it manifested itself in those penalties. But, yeah, that has to be wiped away, cleaned up. You know, the power play looked really good. That's promising. And you've got to – you know, the penalty kill looked good too, really, other than the one. But, man, if you've got it out there six times in a game, then your advantage in this series – is minimized, because you have some good players who just aren't on the ice.
No question about it. Looking forward to game two today at 1:30, pregame at 12:30 here on 102.5 The Game. We'll be back in the morning to recap it and also look ahead to game three. Got a game tomorrow too. Got
game
an interesting
day tomorrow.
Situation. No question about it. For Robbie Stanley and Joe Rexrode and Marquise Munson, this has been Morning Drive. Darren Donick and Chase coming up next here on ESPN 102.5 The Game.